It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Officials at the International Airport in Edmonton, Alberta, recently brought on a new customer service agent to help travelers find their way through the terminal. It chats with passengers, provides updates on flights, and answers questions in 30 different languages. Its name, Furo, short for Future Robot. And while it's still in the testing phase, Furo shows how, as artificial intelligence grows more complex and systems become more interconnected, robotic systems are taking on more complex types of work, including types of work we once thought only humans would be able to handle. This is raising some big questions about the workplace of the future. If robots can increasingly do our jobs, what will we do? Will technology change human work or merely replace it? Today on The Exchange, robots and the future of work, and let's hear from you. How is technology changing the field in which you work? Do you see more upsides than downsides to robot workers? Or do you worry about a future where robots do some of the tasks humans used to do? Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a question or comment on our Facebook page. We have a panel of guests with us for the hour. Judith Doneth is a faculty fellow at Harvard University's Berkman Center for Internet and Society and founder of the Sociable Media Group at the MIT Media Lab. She's the author of The Social Machine, Designs for Living Online. Judith, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Teresa Fort is with us, assistant professor of business administration at Dartmouth's Tuck School. She researches how firms organize global production. And Teresa, great to have you as well.
Great to be here.
And Aaron Smith is senior researcher at the Pew Research Center. He's an author of the recent report, AI, Robotics, and the Future of Jobs. Welcome to you as well, Aaron.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what kind of tasks are we talking about here? What kind of tasks can robots do now or will soon be able to do that might surprise us, Judith?
Almost anything that involves certainly simple movements robots can do. I think the example you gave earlier with the Edmonton Airport is showing how increasingly social things such as interacting with people can be done with robots. That example is an interesting one because while a human agent might be able to pick up on nuances better, they probably don't know 30 languages. So it's an increasing range and number of things, both in the hardware end of robots that move and act among us and software agents that provide information in a human-like way.
Aaron, one of the pieces of Furo is that it's trained to some level to recognize a passenger at the airport who is upset or looks worried or seems to be trying to find his or her way around. That's not something that you would necessarily expect a robot to be able to do.
Absolutely. And when, as you mentioned, we conducted this survey of tech experts, one of which was Judith, as a matter of fact, they really see robots and intelligent agents really permeating all aspects of our lives in a fairly quick manner. And sometimes that's going to be very visible, as in the case of Furo or as in the case of driverless cars. But more importantly, and as Judith alluded to, they really see digital agents and algorithms permeating our lives in a way that's almost invisible to end users. So in many cases, when people are planning their days or engaging in customer service requests, they'll be interacting with digital agents and not even really realizing whether they're interacting with a human being on the other end of the line or a computer.
Teresa, we put out a question to our Exchange Facebook page. Are you worried a robot will have your job one day? We got a response from Chris who wrote, yes, I'm worried, and I'm an English teacher. So you have this growing perception that there are not jobs that are automated and there are jobs that are human, that there's an increasingly blurred line between the two.
Absolutely. I think that that's true, and the line does get more blurred. I mean, certainly we think that routine, more rules-based jobs are going to be easier to automate, as they've also been easier to move offshore. But I think there are legitimate concerns about whether or not your job can be automated. That said, you know, you talked about more broadly, how does automation and how do these changes affect us both in ways we see and in ways we don't see. I mean, a lot of the goods that people are consuming today, we don't realize, but they've actually been produced in factory floors where, you know, there's computer-aided design and computer-aided manufacturing software that is replaced the traditional way that goods were made, but that we still require engineers and we still require skilled workers to run that software and run those machines. So it's not, you know, the case that they can replace all jobs.
There have been concerns about machines disrupting human work going back to the start of the Industrial Revolution, the spinning jenny, the cotton gin, and so many other examples. Judith, are these developments, the idea of the skilled robotic worker or the automated technological solution, just the latest in that ongoing cycle where new technology gets developed and humans adapt? Or is there perhaps something substantially different about today?
I think there is a substantial difference today because of the type of work that robots are able to take over. And in particular, there's a strong social and psychological piece of it that was absent in the past. So in the past, we really saw machines taking over the physical side of the human. There's sort of the John Henry versus the train. We don't try and race trains anymore. But what's happening now with computers and particularly software agents and intelligent robots is that they're taking over more and more tasks that require intellectual ability and, most tellingly, social ability. And that's a qualitative difference because it means that we're losing jobs that require those skills, but it also requires really rethinking when do we really want a human to be the thing or person we're interacting with, and when do we not care anymore? When is it okay that the being that we're dealing with is not really alive and probably not really conscious?
And it also means that at some level that the artificial intelligence that's behind those machines, the programming, the characteristics, is sophisticated enough that you can even bring up a question like that, whether you would want to have a human or, for lack of a better term, an artificial interface.
Right. And there's a very interesting distinction of whether the programming is so sophisticated that it's really doing the same thinking and having the sort of same concepts going through it that a human would, or is it really just acting the role? And basically almost all the robots we deal with are acting that role. So they are doing the external acts that, you know, an agent would do or a cashier or a customer service person would do. And a lot of times we say that's okay. They're increasingly moving into jobs where we really need to think about what is the sort of process behind the words or behind the actions and what significance do we give that to? Such as if you're talking to a doctor or a psychiatrist, do you care what they're thinking of you or do you just care what they're saying?
All of those positions, Aaron, that Judith just mentioned, agent, cashier, customer service, even doctor, or psychiatrist, those are all essentially white-collar work. They're service work. They're not necessarily the machine in the factory floor. And that was a big piece of the recent report that Pew did, that you co-authored, that found that this is perhaps a big development, that we're starting to see automation and robots moving into these lines of work in a growing number.
Absolutely. And that was one of the big concerns that came through in the responses that we got, both that these types of advances are moving into new types of work and also that it's happening very quickly and it's making it really hard or it's going to make it really hard for people in those industries to retrain. So when we looked at the people who were sort of most pessimistic or had the most sort of dystopian outlook on this, they really see this as driving potentially the next sort of advance in income inequality. And they see a future where a lot of people are either on the fringes of employment and simply can't compete with a lot of these machines and digital agents, with a small number of people doing very well for themselves, but not nearly enough to make up for all of the people who have been sort of moved down to the lower rungs of society. So in terms of the big issues that came up in the people that we talked to, that was really a key theme there, is that sort of growing inequality, that movement into types of work that haven't been impacted to a great degree, and at a speed that makes it really hard for people to adjust and evolve in terms of their careers and their employment prospects.
Today on The Exchange, robots and the future of work. As computers and robotic machinery grow more sophisticated, there are concerns automation is making it harder for human workers to compete. But others say robotic workers will lead to better jobs, more productivity, and even an age of leisure for people. We're talking with three experts on how the rise of the robot may change the face of the workforce, and we hope you'll join us as well by calling 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR, or send an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Teresa Ford, what is the calculus that a company might do? What are the factors that might consider a company as they decide these tasks might be better handled by an automated task rather than human workers, or vice versa?
Well, so certainly I alluded earlier to the computer-aided design and computer-aided manufacturing software, and that was originally developed in the aircraft industry and the automobile industry, and that was because these were very complicated production processes, and there were big potential gains to specialization to allowing different suppliers to just focus on one component, but then you need that component to fit in to the overall product and to make sure that the overall product is going to work. And so by digitalizing and codifying a lot of the production technology and process into an electronic format, and then actually having machines that can produce those products, these industries were able to take advantage of technology, and as a result, they have experienced lots of gains to specialization. But you know, as Aaron was alluding to, there are certainly consequences in terms of certain types of workers might get displaced. Of course, the flip side is that there's an increase in demand for those workers who can, engineers who can program the technology, who can run the machines. So I think firms that are thinking about whether or not to make this investment decision are thinking, you know, what are the costs versus benefits going to be? What are the gains going to be to implementing it? And certainly what we've seen in manufacturing is that it has allowed for quite a lot of gains to specialization in terms of individual tasks being done in different locations. And you can just think of Adam Smith's, you know, pin factory, where you had workers that could specialize in one small task. They could become much more productive. And so those productivity gains are a positive from this type of technology improvement.
We'll continue our conversation on robots and the future of work here on The Exchange. If you'd like to join us, our number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Much more after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR.org is your source for New Hampshire political news and voter resources for elections 2014. Click over right now to read interviews with candidates running in the Republican primary for U.S. House, airing all week on Morning Edition. Political news and voter resources are online every day at NHPR.org. Mostly cloudy for today, slight chance of some showers, high temperatures in the mid-70s. Mostly cloudy tonight, lows from mid to upper 50s. Mostly cloudy tomorrow, highs lower 70s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from friends of Mount Sunapee, announcing a hearing on the future of Mount Sunapee State Park, Tuesday the 26th, 6 p.m. at the Base Lodge. Information at friendsofmountsunapee.org. And AAA Northern New England Trusted Road Service for over 100 years, providing personal insurance protection for all of your family's needs. Insurance for your auto, home, and life. 877-279-1004. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Today on The Exchange, we're looking at robots and the future of work. We hope you'll call in with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment and question on our Facebook page. With us this hour, Aaron Smith, senior researcher at the Pew Research Center and author of the recent report, AI, Robotics, and the Future of Jobs. Judith Doneth, faculty fellow at Harvard University's Berkman Center for Internet and Society and founder of the Sociable Media Group at the MIT Media Lab. She's also the author of The Social Machine, Designs for Living Online. And Teresa Fort, assistant professor of business administration at Dartmouth's Tuck School. She researches how firms organize global production. Judith, to pick up on what we were talking about just before the break, the kind of thinking that a company makes as it starts to consider whether an automated system or robots might be useful. In some sectors of the economy, you're seeing the development of apps and software that make those barriers to automation much lower. You can get involved. So I'm thinking of a technology like the Square system that so many shops and retailers now use for credit card system. You don't have to buy an immense amount of hardware. You buy a little attachment to your iPad or your cell phone. And you can see how a system like that, a small piece of hardware or an app or two might make it easier for those kinds of decisions. It's another factor then for businesses to consider.
Right. And so I think there's a lot of efficiency that you get from both in terms of employing people for the company, and there's efficiency for the person, say, moving through the cashier lane. You know, for instance, if you go to a lot of drugstores, you have a choice. You can go to a cashier, or you can go to a little automated, you can think of it as a little robot cashier that you just sort of scan all your barcodes at. And so part of the question is, I think, for people to deal with is, what's the value? Okay, first of all, let's put aside for now the enormous question of what's happening to the people whose jobs are disappearing. But just look at it from the customer side. What is the value of that human interaction? And I think for a lot of people, they say, you know, I wasn't getting the greatest human interaction when I went through the cashier line. It's much more efficient for me to go and deal with this machine and just run my barcode through. And you start seeing, you know, if you do this, you know, one decision at a time, you start having a world where we go on vacation to little villages in France and we think, oh my God, it's so lovely. There's these storekeepers here and they ask us about our day and they give you a special piece of bread. It's just such a wonderful way of life. But when we get home, we really want that efficiency of moving through a machine. We don't, we don't have to talk to the bank teller anymore. All of us go to, you know, ATMs, which are little robot bank tellers. So I think a lot of it is for people to think about when do we value human interaction, because it's the calculus for it is both the calculus of how well does a firm do by replacing workers with robots. There's a question for the enormous question of the future of employment. What happens to the people whose jobs are replaced? Are they getting better work? Are we going to rethink our culture so that a life of leisure is one of interesting education and creative output versus being just miserably unemployed? And there's also the question for the rest of us is how much of our interactions do we want to keep as human ones versus ones with machines?
Aaron, that question came up in the Pew study that people were thinking about how it is that how it shakes out that in some circumstances we would want more of a human touch, and then in other cases it seems like we're willing or prefer to interact with something more automated.
Right, and one of the things that came through very clearly that both Judith and Teresa have alluded to a little bit is this notion of what's good for a single firm or a single individual and what's good for the broader health of our economy as a whole or as our society as a whole. And so what may be very logical and rational for one firm to do in terms of increasing productivity by replacing workers, if everybody does that, then maybe that's not so good for the economy as a whole because nobody's there to buy all the products that those robots and digital agents are cranking out. So one of the themes that really came through repeatedly when we talked to folks was this notion that we really, as a society, need to, think through this in a proactive way and really address this head on rather than simply sort of accepting whatever happens with the technology. And when we look at people who have a more positive outlook about what's going to happen and a more negative outlook about what's going to happen, it doesn't necessarily boil down to what they think is going to happen with the technology, but really what they think about our capacity to handle tough problems in terms of our political systems and our business institutions and our educational institutions is really where a lot of those distinctions lie.
Teresa, one of the issues that came up as I was thinking about this question, where we prefer to have human interaction, where we prefer to have automation, is and Judith mentioned the grocery line where you can choose self-checkout and you can choose to go through the line. If you are, say, trying to buy a bottle of wine, the automated system will stop where it stands as soon as you scan that wine bottle, and it will insist on having a human come over. It seems like there's a certain level of authority and decision-making that at least thus far, we are not conceding to machine process, but that we want to, at least perhaps for legal concerns, we want to make sure that there is some kind of human accountability that remains in the process.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that even though we've made big advances in technology, it still does tend to be the more routine rules-based jobs that are easier to allocate to machines. And I'd love to go back just for a second and touch on some of the points that that Aaron was raising. So I think there are these concerns about jobs getting replaced, human jobs getting replaced by machines. And certainly there's an individual firm is not thinking about the overall economy when it makes its decision about whether or not to implement new technology. It's looking at the marginal cost, the fixed cost of implementing that technology, and then it's looking at what are the gains going to be, either in reduced labor cost or increased productivity. But certainly when the firm is making that profit-maximizing decision, and lots of individual firms make those decisions, we do think, you know, they're making them because it's going to increase their profitability, and that certainly is going to make the pie bigger. And at least there is the potential for everyone to be better off when that happens. Now, of course, there are these really big, important questions about the fact that there could be big reallocative differences in terms of who's going to gain and who's going to lose, and is it going to be the higher skilled workers who gain versus the lower skilled workers to lose. But I think we want to at least have this idea in the back of our minds that these productivity gains certainly can make the pie bigger, and that has the potential to make everyone better off. It's just going to be up to us to have the institutions and frameworks in place to allow people to take advantage of the new gains.
Today on The Exchange, robots and the future of work. As computers and robotic machinery grow more sophisticated, we're looking at the concerns that automation might make it harder for human workers to compete, or whether they could lead to better jobs, more productivity, or even an age of leisure for people. If you'd like to join us, the number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Steve is calling now from George's Mills. Hi, Steve. You're on The Exchange.
Thanks. You're talking a lot about the new types of jobs that might be created, or the demand that will be there to implement some of these systems or create these systems, and you've mentioned engineering. But are there specific engineering titles, specific job positions that you think are the ones that are very short or that are going to be in high demand versus these other jobs that might sort of fade off?
It's a great question, Steve. And I'll turn to you, Judith. What robot maintenance perhaps is an emerging career field?
Well, certainly the whole field of artificial intelligence would be one where, you know, there's a lot of these things are still in their infancy. You talked about the wine bottle example. Now, without getting into whether it's a good idea or not to leave the human out of it, what you would need to get rid of the human in that situation is you would need face recognition systems. You would want something that could create a gentle barrier to a 12-year-old who's trying to pass themselves off. You need the systems that would be able to evaluate all kinds of fake ID, etc. So some of these pieces exist, some don't. So the engineering that goes into a lot of the social interaction is still very, very primitive. So things that could handle social interactions a lot better, you know, you mentioned earlier, again, something that's trying out being an agent in the airport, but being able to pick up on the subtle cues of who wants to talk to it, who doesn't, are, again, still in their infancy. And, you know, there's a whole range of certainly, for instance, the whole development of autonomous cars, et cetera. So I think even just looking in the world of the future of robotics, there's a huge number of tremendous engineering problems that still need to be solved to have this future, whether it's a utopia or dystopia.
And Aaron, going hand in hand with the engineering side, there's also the design side. Say a robot that's working, say, in a children's hospital in Boston is going to be very different from the robot that is doing manufacturing in Detroit or a service agent at the airport.
Absolutely. And so the folks that we spoke with, obviously, the sort of the engineering and design side is a huge one. But beyond that, they really made the point that there's a lot of things that robots can't really do very well. And Judith alluded to several of them. They can't be empathic in the way that humans can. They can't be creative. They can't apply judgment to the rules that they've been given when there's an exception to those rules. So those types of skills are ones that the people we spoke with really pointed to as being sort of uniquely human, and that jobs utilizing those capacities are going to be at least relatively immune to automation in the future. But certainly a lot of people expressed sort of sympathy for the young people and sort of college graduates of the moment trying to figure out and sort of game this out 10 years in the future and pick a career path that is going to be relatively insulated from all of these changes is going to be really, really tough. And so certainly a lot of the folks we spoke with expressed sympathy for people who are trying to come up with a career path today as all of these changes are going on and are going to be becoming much more prevalent in the next 10, 15 years or so.
Steve, thanks so much for that call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Here are some thoughts that Robin from Hanover sent us by email, saying, the question is not whether a robot can do your job. For most jobs, the answer is no. The relevant question is how many parts of your job a robot could do. For most jobs, the answer is plenty. In jobs where a large enough portion can be robotized, employers will do that, then redefine the remainder tasks into what we perceive as a new job, but it's mostly reassignment of old jobs. Robin continues, the more we get repackaged and reassigned by mechanization, automation, and robotization, the more wealth and the better off we all are. Thank you for that email, Robin. And Teresa, we often frame this kind of conversation as an either or. You have a robot worker or you have a human worker. But I think of my own job and how much technology is involved in that. And it's not necessarily that a robot is going to replace me, but that a robot may end up just working alongside me as it does now.
Absolutely. So
theoretically speaking, I don't actually have a robot sitting next to me.
Right, right. So I think kind of the key question here is to what extent is a robot or is automation technology more generally a complement or a substitute for the work that you're doing? And so you can think about in some cases where, you know, there's a research paper recently about how the scanner in a grocery store dramatically increased worker productivity. And so that same worker could now, using the electronic scanner, get through customers much more quickly. So output at the grocery store increased, the worker's productivity increased. You're going to see that worker's wage go up. Of course, that's going to be different if the technology is just a complete substitute for the worker. And those jobs that can be more fully substituted by technology are going to be the jobs that are more at risk. And so because those tend to be the more routine rules-based jobs, they tend to be the lower skill jobs. And so I think that's why we do see that this this issue with technology and automation speaks a lot to the inequality concerns that people have, that we're going to have rising inequality based on the types of skills and education that different workers have.
Robin, thank you so much for that email. Let's take another call. Lena is calling now from Portsmouth. Hi, Lena. You're on the exchange.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I work at Strawberry Bank Museum, and there we have so many different ways for our visitors to interact with the history that we teach. We've got videos, we've got cell phone tours, but we also have tour guides. And then we have costumed role players. And time and time again, we find that the folks that are coming back and telling us what a good time they had and what an amazing experience, they're the ones that interacted with the people, especially with our costumed role players, so they could really have some empathy for what was going on in the past.
Lena, thanks so much for sharing that experience. And Aaron, this sounds a lot like what we were talking about earlier, where you start to see people who are looking for that human experience are finding it in a place like Strawberry Bank. But then there are also the interactive and the automated abilities to look through historical documents at a historic site or a museum, if they prefer that, or if they want both.
Absolutely. And so this was again, one of the themes that came through is this for people who are, you know, sort of hopeful about where we're going is this idea that, you know, it's much more interesting to as a museum worker to be doing the role playing and sort of giving that extra value add to people rather than simply reciting facts or helping them find where they need to go. And so to the extent that we can offload some of our day-to-day drudgery, the types of jobs or portions of our jobs that people, frankly, don't really like doing that much, and let, you know, the humans focus on the more interesting parts, the parts that inspire them more, that's a big win for humans. So when we looked at the people who were sort of hopeful about where this is going, that's really where they see this heading, is sort of robots and digital agents handling the stuff we don't want to do and allowing us to focus on, you know, our hobbies, being creative, or, you know, simply not working and just spending more time doing other things that we'd rather be doing instead.
And then, Judith, that could conceivably, at least for the people who are still working, and that's a big question, the relationship between those people and their work could change. They could find more fulfilling.
Right. I mean, the work, there's a lot of work that is very fulfilling. So part of the question is, what are the things we actually want to automate away? You know, you don't want, you know, just because you can automate something, there's the history of automation has often been with the story that it was about taking the drudgery out of work and or taking dangerous things or stuff that was physically very difficult. You don't necessarily want to automate away the things that people really love to do. And you also want to really understand when is it that there's that human connection that's really important, and also at what point have you automated it so that it's just, you know, you've taken, you know, as the call-in or the letter said, you take a piece here and a piece here, and then you just have that little piece that says, oh, well, I can talk to you, but a lot of my interaction has been automated away. So let's take the example of, say, a nurse. If you take away a lot of the physical, there's an unpleasant level of physicality to being a nurse. So maybe you automate some of that away. You still want to have the empathy of talking to that person, but you don't want to automate it to the extent that it's, you know, this, you know, 10-minute exchange with a person also, because there is an integrated level that working with that person and some of the physicality of that work was part of what made that empathy really happen. And those are some things that I don't think we think about deeply enough.
And we'll continue to look at those kinds of questions after a short break here on The Exchange. We're talking about robots and the future of work today. As computers and robotic machinery grow more sophisticated, there are concerns automation may make it harder for human workers to compete. Others say robotic workers could lead to better, potentially more fulfilling jobs, more productivity, and even an age of leisure for people. We're looking at how the rise of the robot may change the face of the workforce, and we hope you'll join us. Again, The Exchange phone number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a question or comment on our Facebook page. We'll continue this conversation after a short break. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, race relations and the search for justice in Ferguson, Missouri. Then, how technology is transforming conservation efforts. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
This morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. New Hampshire weather, mostly cloudy for today. Slight chance of some showers. High temperatures mid-70s. Mostly cloudy tonight. Overnight lows mid to upper 50s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners. And support also comes to us from New Hampshire Center for Nonprofits in its Leadership Summit. Reimagining your community, reinventing your role with keynote Majora Carter, September 19th. Details at nhnonprofits.org. And the Mount Washington Observatory's new high-tech hands-on exhibit titled Extreme Mount Washington, located at the summit of Mount Washington, extrememountwashington.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We'll take a look at some of the big New Hampshire news stories of the week, and you can join us with your thoughts by calling in at 1-800-892-6477, or you can find us on Twitter or Facebook to continue the conversation there. Today in The Exchange, a look at robots and the future of work. Joining us today is Teresa Fort, Assistant Professor of Business Administration at Dartmouth's Tuck School. She researches how firms organize global production. Aaron Smith, Senior Researcher at the Pew Research Center, author of the recent report AI, Robotics, and the Future of Jobs. And Judith Doneth, Faculty Fellow at Harvard University's Berkman Center for Internet and Society and founder of the Sociable Media Group at the MIT Media Lab. She's the author of The Social Machine, Designs for Living Online. Again, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or exchange at nhpr.org. Teresa Fort, these kinds of developments are not necessarily going to play out in every country in the same way, are they? Some countries may be better suited to deal with robotic workers or be better equipped to move in that direction than others.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So it's the case that I think for the U.S., we have a comparative advantage relative to other countries in higher skilled jobs. And so we're probably going to have a comparative advantage in these industries that are more higher tech, that require these engineers that can design new softwares and that can implement them. There's other countries where they just don't have the level of human capital that's going to be necessary to take advantage of these new high-tech industries that come out. And so you're going to see those countries that are going to probably still be specializing in more labor-intensive jobs. And then the question is going to be, to what extent do those labor-intensive jobs eventually become threatened by automation?
Aaron, you had mentioned earlier on in the show about the concern that we may see growing income inequality as we see more mechanized work. And you can look at that issue in the context of a single country like the United States, but you could also look at it through the global economy, that there would be well-off countries that have increased productivity with a lot of robot work, and then you have countries that are not doing so well and might be pushed further and further away from development and growth.
Yeah, and as Teresa mentioned, a number of the folks we spoke with made a similar argument that a lot of countries right now whose comparative advantage is inexpensive human labor may lose that advantage in a world where robots and algorithms are doing more and more work for us. And so a lot of the countries that have been kind of rising up from developing world up into developed world status may actually be harmed much more than countries like the United States by this. So a number of folks that we spoke with made the same argument that it's very much going to depend potentially on where in the world you are, and that this might actually be an area where we see industries moving back to the United States or Europe that have, in the last 10, 20 years been going to China or Mexico or places like that.
Judith, is it also possible, though, that countries that are not tied to the way that things have been done for decades past, you think of the factory model that the U.S. has used, developing countries might be able to, rather than having to make a difficult transition and figure out what to do about that existing infrastructure, that they may be able to jump on new technologies more quickly?
Well, a lot of it really depends on how much value, I mean, on the surrounding values around automation and around work and around what is the meaning of leisure. I mean, Teresa gave an example earlier of a grocery store where you had a bunch of cashiers and then they get scanners, and then, okay, you can have one cashier can run more groceries through more quickly, and so that cashier's productivity goes up higher. What happens next is an open question, because what I think is most likely to happen and happens in most cases is many of the other cashiers get laid off. You have a few who are doing that throughput, and Teresa said, well, their productivity is higher, so their salary is higher. I'm not sure their salary always becomes higher. I think they often become more productive with the technology, but they're not getting a higher wage. That greater efficiency goes to higher profits for the company, not a higher salary for the more efficient cashier. And so I think a lot of it's going to be, what is the culture? Do you have a culture that says, yes, you're producing more, we're going to reward you more, we're going to distribute this better? So the questions aren't just around how well a country or a firm or a city can adopt to the actual technology itself, but how do they adopt the notion of how do you share the wealth of the automation? What do you do with that time outside it? So I think it's certainly very culture dependent, but I don't know that we have shining examples of the cultures that are going to lead us to the utopian visions that go with this.
And Teresa, on top of the issue of culture, there's also the public policy level. Do countries, states, cities start to tackle these kinds of questions of what do you do then if you have big concerns about nationwide unemployment resulting from displacement of workers? What's the right policy then? Or what's the policy change do you make to a workforce that is continuously and fundamentally changing in some ways?
Well, I think going back to some of the points that Aaron had raised earlier, we want to make sure that we have the institutional framework, the education system, job retraining programs that are going to allow for workers to develop the necessary skills in an environment that is going to be changing very quickly. So they're not necessarily going to be able to know, you know, when they enter high school, what job or career to pursue, because technology, things evolve quickly. What we want is to have a system in place that allows workers to acquire new skills. So we could look at a country like Denmark that has been sort of a leader in terms of having a very flexible workforce. Unlike a lot of other European countries, people transition in and out of jobs quite frequently, but they also have a big safety net, and they have a very well-functioning job retraining program that has allowed workers to acquire new skills when their particular firm or industry gets hit. And I think that having that those kind of programs in place is going to be very important, and we just have not so far had the political will to do that in this country.
Here's an email that tackle some of the same topics. It's from Margo, who writes, robot workers are available 24 hours a day. ATMs now give us access to banking services 24/7. Merchandise can be made 24/7 via automated sales clerks such as Amazon.com and goods delivered the following day. There is an increasing expectation of availability of people 24/7. Time zones have begun to become immaterial. She says, how do you see this figuring into how we look at robots? Aaron, what do you make of that?
Well, that's a good question. And, you know, I think it gets back to this notion of, you know, what do we as a society want the end result of this whole process to be? And so we've talked a lot about culture, about policies. One of the things that came through very clearly is, regardless of how they see things playing out, there was a real sense in which the folks that we spoke with were concerned that we're not thinking through all of these decisions, and we're sort of allowing ourselves to progress along the path without considering, you know, how we'll respond to this new world. And so one of the things that really came through clearly was this notion that if we don't start thinking through these issues and don't start planning for contingencies, then we might wind up in a situation that we really don't want to be in. And it's better to make some of those tough choices now and really start thinking through these issues within our institutions and in our society as a whole before this happens, rather than when it's already upon us.
Thanks so much, Margo, for that email. And here's one from Sean in Manchester, who says, I work to live, not live to work. I also believe in working smarter, not harder. Technology is meant to make our collective lives easier. As we become more efficient, we should have more free time to enjoy life, maybe shift to 30-hour weeks. Instead, we work more, faster, harder to fill that time. I think we need a big cultural shift from profit-based competition to quality-of-life-based collaboration. Thank you, Sean, for that email. Teresa, what do you make of that? This could be a chance to rethink some of these fundamental aspects of work and life and how they relate to each other.
So I think this actually raises an interesting point that in economics people are a little surprised by. So we think about there being an income and a substitution effect. And so as people earn more money, they might actually substitute away from working and actually enjoy more leisure. And the reality is that we haven't actually seen that that happen. In fact, high wage earners tend to work more. And so that's a little bit of a puzzle. And I think that we'd still need to understand, we're still working on models that explain consumer behavior. But in general, you know, we're making these decisions on the margin, how much to work versus how much to play. And it may be the case that, you know, jobs don't necessarily allow for us to substitute away, take, you know, an extra 2 weeks of vacation. If you're going to have the high paying job, then it demands that you're there a lot. And so certainly as workers demand that more, we may see changes towards that. But I think it's going to be gradual, and it's hard to orchestrate that in a system in which markets are allocating resources based on prices.
Sean, thanks so much for that email. Let's hear now from Ian, who is calling from Derry. Hi, Ian. You're on the Exchange.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. So, you know, I think about this conversation, this whole topic, and I know we're at the very ground level of the conversation right now, but when I think of it and extend it out into the future and what it could be, I can't help but end up at a picture like the movie WALL-E, where you have all these you know, these overweight people floating around in chairs, and everything's being done for them, and they've kind of slipped into not doing anything. And so I know this is a hard conversation to have on a technological, economic, even political level. But, you know, I can't help but think that this conversation starts to bring in the more philosophical questions about the purpose of people. You know, if we take away work, are we in essence taking away part of the thing that makes us human? And I'm wondering if any of your guests have any comments on that, and where that level of conversation fits into this big picture.
It's a big, big question, Ian. Thanks so much for calling. Judith, when we talk about the nature of work, we're not merely talking about what it is that a person does all day, but in a way, what it means.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent question. And, you know, I think a lot of this goes back to thinking about what kind of culture do we want to have for this future of, you know, to attain that kind of utopian version of the future. And so in some ways, the retraining isn't just about a retraining to think about how do you work, but a retraining of what is our notion of leisure. And, you know, WALL-E is the dystopian view of leisure. For those who haven't seen it, you know, it is a lot of, you know, huge overweight people just sitting on their backs being sort of spoon-fed things as they lie in simulated sunlight. And that's probably not the leisure we want for a future of abundant leisure. And so I think when we think about the education system of the future, it both has to be flexible about retraining people for the future of work, but thinking about what does it mean to get up in the morning and have something that seems meaningful and interesting for you to be doing. And, you know, and what do you care about? Is it something creative? Is it something physical? But, you know, really rethinking what is the value we give to how we spend our day. And we do live in a culture that is very, very focused on productivity, on making money, on a very traditional capitalist version of work. And so I think to go with the automation, we need to think about how we want to live. And I think it's not just a leisure that's the antithesis of work, of leisure as doing nothing, but it's about thinking about what is the ways we want to spend our time, whether it's socially with family and friends, whether it's creatively, et cetera, but that's going to require really rethinking our education system also.
Jason in Manchester. By the way, thank you, Ian, for that call. Jason in Manchester writes in to say, perhaps the goal of any decent society should not be 0% unemployment, but 100% unemployment. I hope technology ushers in a new paradigm for the way we think of the nature of purpose. Tying into the questions that Judith was just talking about, Teresa, what do you make of that idea that we're rethinking some big, big questions here as we look forward?
Yeah, I think that we are trying to rethink those questions. I think as Aaron and Judith have both pointed out, it's hard for in a capitalist economy where we've got prices that are allocating resources to their most efficient allocation, It's hard to know exactly how we fit in, you know, what are our preferences for the type of work that we want to do and the types of activities that we want to automate versus not automate. We don't have sort of the government making those decisions for us, and I don't think that would be ideal. I mean, the government's not necessarily going to be able to know how different individuals value different activities and which interactions should be automated or not. It is a little hard to think of a world with 100% unemployment, since, of course, with unemployment, you get people not necessarily having the resources that they want to consume goods. So it's hard to imagine an economy that would function well in that way. But I guess maybe robots could figure out an answer to that.
Well, whatever the answer ends up being, Aaron, one issue, and I'll just ask this quickly, is that technology often outpaces policy. Public policy takes time. It takes a lot of study. Oftentimes, it just is a process that moves slowly, and technology does not move slowly, certainly not these days.
Absolutely. And one of the things, you know, we can look in the last year, and so, you know, driverless cars are becoming more and more of a reality. The AP just announced that a lot of their earnings reports now are going to be written by algorithms instead of journalists. So we've seen any number of advances just in the last year that a few years ago people were saying were decades in the future. So certainly this is something when we speak with folks, they expect the people who study these issues expect this all to happen very quickly. And certainly it appears to be moving in that direction just based on recent history.
So lots to talk about as we look 5, 10, 20 years down the road. And who knows, maybe the next time we have one of these conversations, there might be a robot sitting down with us or in place of, well, probably me, but one of us. I want to say a big thank you to each of you. Judith Doneth, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's Judith Doneth, faculty fellow at Harvard University's Berkman Center for Internet and Society and founder of the Sociable Media Group at the MIT Media Lab, also the author of The Social Machine, Designs for Living Online. Teresa Forth, thanks so much for your time as well.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Teresa Ford, assistant professor of business administration at Dartmouth's Tuck School. She researches how firms organize global production. And Aaron Smith, great to talk with you as well.
Thank you very much.
Aaron Smith, senior researcher at the Pew Research Center and an author of the recent report, AI, Robotics, and the Future of Jobs. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. And our producer is Faith Meixel. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Brady Carlson, in for Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
The Exchange. It gets New Hampshire talking, whether it's schools or alternative fuels, the economy or astronomy, transportation, immigration, or what it means to be first in the nation. It's been said that the public interest is best served by the free exchange of ideas. I'm Laura Kanoy. Be part of our exchange, weekday mornings at 9, here on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and from Novus Engineering, an employee-owned company providing diversified environmental, geotechnical, and civil engineering and consulting services to clients throughout the Northeast. And Goff Wilson, a global immigration law firm helping businesses and individuals with employment visas worldwide, online at goffwilson.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Attorney General Eric Holder met with the parents of slain teenager Michael Brown yesterday, as well as others in Ferguson, Missouri. The unarmed black teen was shot and killed August 9th by a white police officer. Outrage over the incident sparked days of protests and violence. Holder pledged a full and fair investigation. Missouri prosecutors are presenting evidence to a grand jury for possible prosecution of the officer. An update on efforts to get to the facts related to the shooting and to address familiar but deeply troubling questions about police tactics and race relations. But first, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. In a record settlement, Bank of America has agreed to pay $17 billion, ending a federal investigation into mortgage securities the bank sold as the financial crisis heated up. Attorney General Eric Holder says the amount is the largest mortgage settlement to date with justice and resolves an investigation dealing largely with Bank of America's purchase of Merrill Lynch and Countrywide Financial Corporation.
It addresses allegations that Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, and Countrywide each engaged in pervasive schemes to defraud financial institutions and other investors in structured financial products known as residential mortgage-backed securities, or RMBS.
The deal includes $7 billion in consumer aid. An American doctor who caught the Ebola virus while working in Liberia is being released from the hospital today. As NPR's Rob Stein reports, the U.S. missionary recovered after being airlifted to an Atlanta hospital.
Dr. Kent Brantley is being discharged from the Emory University Hospital. He and another U.S. missionary, Nancy Wrightbull, are the first Ebola patients ever brought to the United States to be treated. They were airlifted by a specially equipped plane and isolated in a high-security hospital unit. Both received an experimental drug called ZMapp, though it remains unclear what role that played in their recovery. Dr. Brantley